Hi everyone, I'm Mark Casper. Welcome to No Spoiler Reviews, the podcast for movie reviews with the surprises left in. If you ever felt like you've already seen the film just by reading a review or had the story spoiled by its trailers, then this is the podcast for you. In this month's episode, you'll find all the latest movie news and No Spoiler Reviews, including Uncle Frank, Antebellum, Judy and Punch, Sputnik, and Nigerian Prince, whilst we also revisit Tony Scott's debut, The Hunger, on Blu-ray, and also see what's worth streaming in our Lockdown Lowdown feature. Also, as promised, we have another one of our behind-the-scenes interviews now available as a separate podcast, where this time I'm talking to John Tulleen about life as a movie subtitler. So if that's your kind of thing and you don't like knowing the ending before you start, then let's crack on with this episode's Lockdown Lowdown. So, what's worth streaming at the moment? Well, in our usual look at new streaming releases, forgotten favourites and other bargains, in this episode I'll be checking out iTunes, Netflix and Amazon to see what's on offer over the next 2 weeks. Let's start with iTunes Premium Videos on Demand. In iTunes Premium VODs or Videos on Demand, those are the ones where you can expect to pay around 20-odd euros / dollars to watch them on first release, the current pick of the crop looks like this. Jungle Land. Two brothers on the down and out in Massachusetts need a break. One is good with his fists, while the other is less reliable running his mouth. Sounds familiar? Well, whilst there are discernible echoes of David O. Russell's The Fighter, with Mark Wahlberg as the fighter and Christian Bale as his older brother / trainer, it is the British pairing of Jack O'Connell and Charlie Hunnam that elevates his well-worn path to a fight movie into arresting viewing. Owing money to Jonathan Majors' gangster, there's only one way out for the boys, and they have to deliver a mysterious cargo en route to their next fight. Needless to say, the road ahead will be a rough one. The Informer. Sticking with the crime theme, ex-convict Pete Coslow intentionally gets himself locked up so that he can infiltrate the mafia at a high-security prison. Similar to Jungle Land, this is another middleweight drama about being forced into doing something you don't want to do. Also similar is the heavyweight casting of its roles. Rosamund Pike and Clive Owens are the feds trying to take down the mafia, and Joel Kinnaman is Pete, their expendable asset. To be honest, there's nothing exceptionally new here, but Common does add a nice spoke to Clive Owens' smoothly running machine, and as previously said, the cast is top-notch. What is top of the line, though, is The Way That I See It, and the access that Pete Souza had as Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama's private press photographer. Standing shoulder to shoulder with them as the big decisions came down to the wire, his photos were meant to be impartial testimony and showed the unvarnished humanity at the heart of government. However, with the arrival of Donald Trump Jr., everything changed. For a man who had no political axe to grind, Pete Souza thought it was about time that he remind Donald Trump just how the job should be done via Twitter. All of which brings us to Antebellum, an ambitious horror thriller with Janelle Monáe as a black woman caught in a terrifying trap, which really does deserve an in-depth, no-spoiler review. So let's do that. Antebellum. Brought back on horseback, runaway slave Eden, as played by Janelle Monáe, is beaten by her owner, a Confederate general, as played by Eric Lang. Unable to fall asleep at night, Eden stares at the ceiling, trying to dream of a better life. However, what she doesn't realise is that it is only a phone call away. The 6-month popular PVOD movie to be downloaded since the COVID-19 pandemic started, Antebellum is a movie that reaches for high concepts in pursuit of even higher ideals. Opening with a yawning string and brass section, directors Gerard Bush and Christopher Renz are intent on taking you back to some of the worst abuses of American slavery. Unlike director Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave, there is no build-up here nor gentle introduction into life on the Antebellum plantation. Policed by Jasper, a sadistic Confederate soldier convincingly played by Jack Huston, this is a reformer plantation where he delights in breaking down runaway slaves. Further imbued with the slow, unshowy pace of Pedro Luque's cinematography, every moment on the plantation feels portentous with dread. However, after the movie's big reveal in the second act, Antebellum's script begrudgingly reveals its central premise, that to be a target in the past is also to be a target in the future. Ambitiously stealing clothes from The Shining's Creepy Girl Twins and Jordan Peele's subversive debut Get Out, Antebellum is a little like Get Out, but where Daniel Kaluuya's character has already started falling into the abyss and must claw his way back to sanity. Scattering plenty of clues across its subsequent scenes, I have to say I found most of them unnecessary. Like breadcrumbs coated with a highlighter pen, it reminded me of Robert De Niro's role in Alan Parker's Angel Heart. There, like here, I appreciate why the clues are laid on a bit thick, but I'd argue that it was to the detriment of both movies on both occasions. For whilst Antebellum is a horror movie of sorts, at its heart, what it really wants to be is a mystery thriller with scenes of unflinching terror. With fascist entitlement and endemic racism clearly in its crosshairs, it commendably doesn't miss the target in creating parallels between the past atrocities and their modern-day parallels. Where it does fall apart, though, is in its depth of character. Buffed with the distracting sheen and gloss of a perfect life, Janelle Monáe's Eden sadly becomes more two-dimensional than three. Whereas the movie's character's personality should be driving the film's plot, most in the end find themselves confined to the back passenger seat. That said, whilst the second act feels a little too disconnected and the plantation owner's wife Elizabeth, as played by Jenna Malone, becomes almost hissibly cartoonish, Antebellum has two redeeming cards off its sleeve. First, it is ambitious, and whilst it doesn't pull off its central concept, I'll give it props for at least trying. The second is Janelle Monáe. In the same way that Lupita Nyong'o defined Jordan Peele's Us, the same is true here. In that rarest of occasions where a movie actually gathers itself the longer it goes on, think Guy Ritchie's Men from U.N.C.L.E., yes, the second and third acts really do belong in a much better movie, Antebellum's latter section reveals an absorbing future through the eyes of the past. In short, see this movie cold. Don't read any of the bylines, praises, paragraphs, or any other movie reviews, lest its surprises be spoilt before you even start. Antebellum is a movie that arguably gets a lot wrong, but you will be engrossed by what it does right. Okay, so before we leave iTunes PVOD offerings, let's check out their 99¢/99p rental bargains, where you can find Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. So, if you are unfamiliar with the time-travelling antics of Bill S. Preston Esquire and Ted Theodore of Logan, well, this is your chance to catch up with both movies for the low, low price of 99 cents. And while some of the humour of the first movies may not have survived cultural progression, both of them are at least imbued with an innocent goofiness that was then mercilessly ripped off by Wayne's World. If you can't remember the setup, they're broadly the same in each movie. The end of the world is nigh, and two California airheads must travel back in time to assemble the greatest team of historical figures to save the day. There you go. What isn't likely to save the day are the time-travelling antics of Jean Reno and Christian Clavier as an 11th century knight and his filthy squire trapped in modern-day France. Now, to put this film in context, this movie cleaned up at the French box office with this gleeful mixture of Pythonesque and Blackadderish condescension and physical humour. But that was back in the day, and that day has passed mightily fast because, for the life of me, I've strained sauerkraut funnier than this movie. However, what is a treat and does feature Jean Reno is the completely bewitching Le Grand Bleu, or The Big Blue, with Jean-Marc Barr as two freedivers. Whilst Reno is brash and lovable Enzo, who is desperate to beat his friend, the movie belongs to Marc Barr's more soulful Jacques Mayol. Blessed with Eric Serra's hypnotic score and infused with gentil humour courtesy of Rosanna Arquette as Jacques' girlfriend, trust me, it will be hard for you not to be taken away by this sublime tale of friendship and romance. Yet one relationship that will forever be under strain is that of puppeteers Mia Wasikowska and Damon Herriman in the dark comedy Judy and Punch. So let's give it a no-spoiler review now. Judy and Punch. In the town of Seaside, which is nowhere near the sea, puppeteers Professor Punch, as played by Damon Herriman, and his wife Judy, as played by Mia Wasikowska, put on the show of their lives. Coarse, bawdy, and unremittingly violent, the show, however, depends upon domestic violence. When he's not battering policemen, crocodiles, or anybody else that he finds upon his way, Mr. Punch enjoys nothing more than battering the puppet of his wife, Judy. However, when Judy confronts him about this, Punch flat out refuses to tone down the violence. Drunk on self-belief, Punch, however, later crashes to earth when, through an act of criminal neglect, he kills their baby. Confronted by an enraged Judy, puppetry becomes reality and Punch kills Judy in their ensuing fight. Fearful of what they might mean for his burgeoning career, Punch decides to bury her in the woods and blame his servants for cooking and eating their child. And yet, for even such a slippery customer as Mr. Punch, there are just some crimes that are far too heinous for fate to let go unpunished. In this modern updating and dramatically fleshed out version of a long-established seaside puppet show, director Mira Falk's movie clearly has its sights set on righting some wrongs. Taking on what ostensibly is a children's show that reinforces domestic abuse, Judy and Punch is an intentionally dark comedy. Yet carving out a line between its comedy and dramatic subplot becomes the dog pulling at the tapestry that it would like to deconstruct. Surrounded by a series of comically distorted exaggerations, none more so than Tom Budge's Mr. Frankly, who is always on the lookout for the next innocent witch to stone, the movie's most charming performance belongs to Terry Norris as Scaramouche. Too old and senile to dance the fandango, his Scaramouche is a moist-eyed, well-intentioned soul that becomes the heart of the film. Leaving the real sparks to fly between Damien Herrion and Mia Wasikowska's warring couple, it is Wasikowska who earnestly carries your attention throughout. Caught between balancing Punch's roguish appeal and heinous crimes, Damon Herrion's Punch falls between the floorboards of mixed genres. Not will-o'-the-wispish enough to make you fall in love with him, nor as dark as he needed to be, the failure of this balancing act affects the overall tone of the movie. Add to this Gillian Jones's arresting, if perplexing, shift in regional accents from sentence to sentence, and you realise that most of the cast have settled on Mumbleset accents, which dance anywhere between the Scottish Highlands and rural Dorset. Unable to shoulder the blame for his crimes and intent on blaming everybody else, sound like anybody you know, Punch's cinematic arrival on streaming is actually quite timing given the US elections and everything else that is currently going on in the world. Set inside a location where the townsfolk are bound together both by fear and knee-jerk prejudice, Judy and Punch could have become a darkly comic mirror of our times. That said, as a fairy tale updated with modern sensibilities and far less saccharine than Maleficent and Al, Judy and the Punch does pull all the right strings, albeit a bit slackly. Don't take my word for it. Give it a go and see if that's the way to do it. Okay, now stop me if you've heard this one before. Some astronauts go into space, something very bad happens, and everybody starts dying. Nope. Never seen this movie before, or possibly you've seen it so many times that you don't even want to think about it. Well, this is what's worrying Noah Blackmore about Igor Abramenko's sci-fi horror flick, Sputnik. Cheers to you for the email and the request, Doc Noah. Now, if you're a new listener to the show, let me explain what this is. A request stop is where you, the listener, can write into us here at No Spoiler Reviews and ask us to do an in-depth, no spoiler review on a film that you'd like to see, or maybe one where you'd just like to hear our take on it. So let's get into it now with a no spoiler review and see if Sputnik will be scary enough to have you gasping for oxygen or just plummet straight through. So let's get into it now with a no spoiler review and see if Sputnik will be scary enough to have you gasping for oxygen or will it just plummet straight to Earth. When cosmonaut Konstantin Vishnyakov crashes straight to Earth, he doesn't do it alone. Hidden inside his body, it seems that a dangerous organism has taken up residence. Now quarantined in a remote Russian facility, his commander reaches out to unorthodox psychiatrist Tatya Klimova to help him. With the organism reluctant to leave its host, can she save Konstantin's life from both the monster and those who would like to weaponize it? From its opening ammonia-infused frames, director Igor Abramenko's sci-fi horror knows that it's walking on hallowed ground. Keen to distance itself from Ridley Scott's magnum opus, aka 1979's Alien, Sputnik starts with the monster already inside the victim with the intention of telling us a very different tale. With its deliberately slow beginning which allows you to grow and sympathise with its characters, this is a movie that understands that in order for you to care, it has to draw you into its repressively 1980s environment. From its brutalist architecture, dour lighting and grey film stock, filmmaker Abramenko has understood that, like Alien before it, if you don't have the right atmosphere, then you don't have anything. As such, the central triangle of Oksana Kinshina as Tatiana, Pyotr Firodev as downed cosmonaut Konstantin, and Fedor Bondarchuk's Colonel Samiradov are all believably rubbed into the narrative. Often hinting at the daily repression felt in 1980s Russia, much of their dialogue believably alludes to life beyond their isolated facility. Further mixing in aspects of Denis Villeneuve's Arrival and David Fincher's Alien 3, Sputnik becomes a film that doesn't rely upon dripping special effects to make its point. Successfully escaping a third act that involves people running down corridors, this is a movie with personal stakes that go far beyond its character survival. Tatiana wants professional redemption, Konstantin wants to meet his orphaned son, and Samiradov wants military glory and however high it'll take him. In an increasingly layered story that is more Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde than Hide and Seek, Sputnik is a refreshing sci-fi horror remix built without being reliant on many of the ingredients that you'll doubtlessly recognize. With every one of its characters becoming even more compromised, its third act builds to a satisfying climax and one which carries one further gentle belly punch in its epilogue. But what about the monster? The CGI, the special effects and all that stuff. Does it look like Alien? Well, folded beautifully into the film's brown and greenish patina, both the effects and the monster are a seamless blend with the film's environment. Yes, it does look cool. But like Ridley Scott's original blue-collar space opera, the creature is a catalyst for the drama, not the movie's raison d'etre. Will you be scared? Will anyone in space be able to hear you scream? Yes and no. Sputnik is both an engrossing story and a movie made on its own terms with a suitably scary plot to offer. So if you're indeed looking for another Alien sequel, then there are plenty of other echo chambers available. But thankfully, Sputnik's rings refreshingly true. So having survived what could have been another sci-fi cash-in, why don't we head over now to Netflix and see what they have for us now? First up is Rogue City. Yep, it's Jean Reno again. No, believe me, this is not the I'm going to only review Jean Reno movies this month episode. It's not. Maybe he's got an exceptional agent or something, but either way, he's also in Olivier Marchal's Rogue City. Now, Olivier Marchal has legs for me in that he wrote, produced, and directed one of the best modern policiers of all time, 36 Quai des Orfèvres. This time set in Marseille, a brutal anti-gang unit must investigate a shooting at a nightclub whilst in competition with a rival unit. And if you've ever seen the TV show Braco, and you really should, by the way, Rogue City is a bit like that, but spun out into movie form. Who is fighting for a future, though, is Emma Thompson as talk show host Catherine Newbery in the comedy drama Late Night. With the evident strands of The Devil Wears Prada showing, the film follows Molly Patel, as played by Mindy Kaling, as a new gauche writer drafted into saving the show from its all-white, male-dominated writer's room. Emma Thompson is great value, and suitably out-terrifies all those around her in a performance that potentially would give Meryl Streep nightmares. But saying that here, the emphasis is much more on comedy than piling up bodies. Someone who's always been on screen for as long as any of us can remember is conservationist Sir David Attenborough. Whether knee-deep in a swamp or being bear-hugged by a gorilla, his sonorous tones have introduced us to a natural world like no other broadcaster before him. However, David Attenborough, Life on Our Planet, is not a biography about him. Instead, it is a witness statement from him to us on the state of the planet and how global ecological disaster can be avoided. Beautifully produced and sumptuously shot, this is both what you expect from him combined with some truths that you may not. Who is having to face a very abrupt change of circumstances is American-born teenager Easy, who is sent to Nigeria by his no-nonsense Nigerian mother in Nigerian Prince. Let's check it out now with an in-depth, no-spoiler review. Nigerian Prince. Privileged Nigerian-American teenager Easy, as played by Antonio J. Bell, arrives in Lagos to find that his two-week stay is a lot longer than he imagined. In fact, it turns out that he's been sent there indefinitely by his mother so he can be toughened up and reminded of his Nigerian heritage. Staying with his sister Grace, as played by Tina Embar, and with no return date set, Easy decides he must find his own way back by secretly returning to the US. Eventually falling in with Grace's internet scammer son Pius, as played by Chinazu Uche, Easy thinks he might have found a way to buy his way back. However, when it comes to family, Easy discovers that it's hard to tell whether you are playing or the one who's being played. In what is commendably Netflix's ongoing mission to broaden your cinematic palette, director Faraday Okoro's Nigerian Prince is an engaging hustler movie with an equally sharp critical eye. As the film itself quickly establishes, Nigeria is a country where everyone is on the make. And Okoro's story wastes no time in pulling you both and Easy into a loud embrace with hidden barbs on the inside of its palm. Now with Easy forcibly enrolled into the story's school of hard knocks, Pius, as played by the excellent Chinazu Uche, introduces Easy into internet scamming as a way of life. Bound together by their separate agendas, Easy, the spoilt fish out of water, and Pius, a big fish drowning in a shrinking pond, must both now exploit their situation so as to escape their respective destinies. More deliberately cinematic than Choco Azure's Iomofe, This Is My Desire, where everyone was pulling each other down to get ahead, Nigerian Prince boasts even stronger performances and a more than solid sense of direction. Finding an attractive balance between melodrama and social commentary, Nigerian Prince, unlike the scam from which it takes its name, won't necessarily promise you millions, but it won't rob you blind either. Take it for the astute, Spike Lee-backed project that it is, and you won't go wrong, my friend. Okay, so let's head over to Amazon Prime. That's the one where you can watch for free as part of their Prime delivery package and see what key titles they have currently on offer for you. So, first up, let's start with the first of several trilogies in Expendables 1, 2, and 3. You see, long after the fall of the big bombastic one hero against an army type movies, Sylvester Stallone found a new action movie formula to reignite the entire genre. In short, get all the biggest names from the previous decade to star in a Dirty Dozen-style shoot-'em-up and call it The Expendables. And you know what? It's worked. Not once, not twice, but three times. By simply increasing the roster of former A-listers, there'll always be somebody there for everybody to cheer on within the whisper-thin plot lines. So if you need a franchise to go with your Friday night pizza-thon, Sly and Amazon might have you covered here. But what if your craving is for something more stylish? The Matrix sequels are still too turgid for you to take on again, and yet you might still need some semi-automatic gunfire to blow away your winter blues. Well, Amazon can provide you with the Underworld trilogy. Comprising of Underworld, Evolution, and Rise of the Lycans, you can follow the one-woman slaughterhouse that is Kate Beckinsale as a vampire version of Trinity from The Matrix, with only werewolf slaughter on her mind. But then if you need something set in the only two real world, then maybe Bombshell might be the caustically sharp explosion you're looking for. Dramatically recreating events that led to the dismissal of former Fox News CEO Roger Ailes for sexual harassment, Bombshell would seem to be firmly on the Me Too zeitgeist. Yet, whilst its three leads, Nicole Kidman, Margot Robbie, and then transformative Charlize Theron as Megyn Kelly, firmly commit to the piece, you might find the film's blunted dialogue too superficial to hold your interest. However, one person who can never be accused of turning in a less than stellar script is Alan Ball, who has written and directed Amazon's latest high-profile release, Uncle Frank, starring Paul Bettany. Let's check it out now with an in-depth, no-spoiler review. Uncle Frank. Stuck in a rural backwater in 1970s America, teenager Beth Bledsoe, as played by Sophia Lillis, is much smarter than the rest of her surrounding family. Dominated by the volcano-like presence of Stephen Root's daddy Mac, everyone in the family must kowtow to his toxic outbursts. Everyone except Uncle Frank, as played by Paul Bettany. A satellite in seemingly terminal orbital decay around Daddy Mac's affections, Uncle Frank is the quiet one who managed to get away. Having found a life for himself as a literature professor in New York University, his open-mindedness attracts Beth's starving intellect. Years later, when Beth decides that New York is the best place to take her A grades, she enrolls at the same university as him. However, when she gets there, she uncovers her deep, dark, hidden secret. Frank is gay and living with longtime partner Waleed Nadim, as played by Peter MacDissey. This fact that he has managed to keep hidden from his family is then further brought into sharp focus when they all receive news of Daddy Mac's death. Reluctantly forced to return home with Beth for the funeral, can Frank finally face his family and resolve the deep-seated trauma that he has spent the entirety of his life running away from? Let's see. Now, before we get started, two words. Alan Ball. Now, for anyone familiar with 1999's American Beauty or 2001's 6 Feet Under, you should already know what to expect from Uncle Frank. Possibly more personal than any of his other signature works, this latest movie also bears a similar hallmark to his other movies. A killer cast. Whether it's Sophia Lillis, who perfectly judges the mood of a teenager looking for guidance, or Steve Zahn's perfectly pitched needy second son, or Margot Martindale's matriarchal presence, everyone makes their contribution count. Yet it's the on-screen relationship of Paul Bettany as Uncle Frank and Peter MacDissey as Waleed that really steals the silverware. In that classic way that Alan Ball layers his characters, Wally initially feels like comic relief to Frank's increasing angst, but he isn't. In classic Ball-like fashion, Wally actually becomes a catalyst to open up the innermost hopes and fears of those around him. Working in opposition to suppress any sense of openness is Stephen Root's Daddy Mac. A mean and bitter man who cannot see beyond his own prejudice, Root gives a fantastically smouldering dislike to every sentence that leaves his mouth. The sum of this works beautifully for Paul Bettany's increasingly fragile performance as Frank. As the man who would, could, and should still be Bond, yes, he really could do it, Paul Bettany reminds us just what a terrific actor he can be when blessed with the right material. Breaking down on the inside, his explosions are suitably jagged and uncomfortable and perfectly suited for a character of this calibre. Again, in keeping with other Alan Ball productions, the choice of music here is a key elevator. Cushioning and absorbing the blows more and more as the movie moves towards its latter stages, the score perfectly finds space within Ball's trademark one-liners, only to tragically disarm you later on. Yes, Alan Ball definitely has something about bereavement dramas, but you can definitely expect to enjoy plenty of laugh-out-loud moments and cry a fair bit, as his Uncle Frank will definitely put solid bacon into your blood. And now, it's interview time. Following on from my previous behind-the-scenes interviews with indie director Carl Golden and Guardians of the Galaxy makeup artist Pascal Rocher, for this episode, Here's a quick snippet of our new full-length interview with veteran subtitler John Tallien, which is now available as a separate podcast for you to download. So, are subtitles there to be read, or are they there just to be glanced at?
They're there to be subconsciously. A good subtitle, you don't even notice that you've read. A good subtitle leaves you with the impression that you saw something and you understood it, even though you didn't really know the language. And that's the big paradox, or I don't want to say it's not a paradox, but it's one of the frustrations of being a subtitler is that the better you are, the less you're noticed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're subtitle, even if people notice your subtitle to say, wow, that was really good. That's not supposed to happen. They're just supposed to be like, oh, right. I read a subtitle, and it just kind of, the information has just been imparted.
So is it just the gist or the literal interpretation that you're going for?
That all depends. Like with all translation, you know, how many translators does it take to screw in a light bulb?
No, tell me.
That depends entirely on context. and that's true. I mean, context is so much the thing with all translation. Like people will ask me, how do you translate this? Well, it kind of depends. You can never answer it. And you can do it differently on a different day. I've had times when I remember I subtitled a movie. I was halfway through and I realized I'd subtitled it in a program that I couldn't use. It was a proprietary program for one of my customers, and I was working for another customer. So I had to start over. And then later I compared the two half hours that I had done at two different times, and they weren't identical.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it's very, very, but the gist is the most important thing, I think. One of the things I have a problem with is when people try to do too much tone. Unless it's important, say that there is a plot point that hinges on somebody speaking a certain way. Yes, then you need to get that tone in there. But I think mostly you try to strip it of tone and just get the information across. What is it? What is the information they're imparting? And sometimes that can be really tough. I remember there was an episode of Scrubs that I had to subtitle into Swedish. And for Swedish TV, you get two lines of 37 characters. That's it. And there was one line, it was about 4.5 seconds, and I had two lines, so I had, what's 2 times 37 is 60, 74. I had 74 characters, that's including spaces, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but there were like three pieces of information that were all necessary for the point to get across. For one joke, I had to get all those three pieces of information in there, and then, you know, of course, you can't break words across lines. And it was one of those, it took probably an hour just to do that one line because I had to compress and move things around and stuff.
And so there you have it. If you'd like to hear more from my interview with John, who has subtitled such indie classics as The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out of the Window and Disappeared, to working on TV shows like The Simpsons and Tonight with David Letterman, please be sure to download our extra bonus podcast, which is available now. Next up is our Blu-ray review of the reissued version of Tony Scott's debut erotic thriller, The Hunger. For this review, I watched the much-improved transfer of the 2015 Blu-ray release. Sadly shorn of any extra artwork or any making of extras, the disc does at least compensate with two very frank and honest audio commentaries from director Tony Scott and actress Susan Sarandon, where they go into the making of the film and what it was like to work with Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie. Now, for those of you who may be unaware, Tony Scott was a graduate from the same filmmaking period as Adrian Lynn, Alan Parker, Hugh Hudson, and most notably his brother, Ridley Scott. Moving on from a highly successful career as a commercials director into features, The Hunger is the film where Scott cut his teeth before moving on to such high-octane crowd pleasers like Top Gun, The Last Boy Scout, True Romance, Crimson Tide, and many, many more. So, let's sink our teeth into his debut feature now, The Hunger. In 1980s New York, swinging couple Miriam and John Blaylock, as played by Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie, teach classical music by day and prowl the nightclubs at night. Looking for willing couples, they lure them back to their townhouse on the promise of sex, only for it to be fatally revealed that they are in fact two vampires out on the hunt. Killing and disposing of their bodies in their basement incinerator, it seems their lives will go on forever this way. However, it doesn't. Now approaching 200 years old, John's body has started to rapidly disintegrate in a matter of days. Approaching specialist Dr. Sarah Roberts, as played by Susan Sarandon, he hopes that her studies in rapid aging may save him. But is it too late for a man who thought he would live forever? Director Tony Scott's lush debut, 1983's The Hunger, is a film so 80s it actually hurts. Now, that's no criticism, far from it. The simple fact of the matter is that in reassessing this movie, it immediately becomes so painfully obvious just how many movies it has in fact influenced. And also, much like the characters it follows, how it hasn't aged a day since. Opening with the suitably vampiric features of Bauhaus's frontman Pete Murphy singing Bela Lugosi's Dead, this is the perfectly ironic image with which to start any vampire movie. Bathed in antiseptic light throughout, the sweat and saliva of The Hunger is a modern gothic horror done right. Brushing past its excesses and uneven storytelling, it's hard not to be captivated by a movie which looks so much like a music video without a song. That said, for many critics of the day, they described it as a perfume advert stretched out to 90 minutes. And given Tony Scott's background in commercials, in a sense, they were right. There are obvious borrowings from Scott's brother Ridley, with its discarded interiors, billowing curtains and flapping white doves, that you could be forgiven for feeling you were already inside J.F. Sebastian's apartment from Blade Runner, minus the toys. Yet the real influence of The Hunger is in its minimalist approach to the vampire lore. Criminally lean by modern-day script standards, The Hunger makes no pretense or attempt to establish its world before the drama begins. In essence, The Hunger is a cold portrait of two aging vampires who thought they could live forever and find themselves being forever old. And possibly more than its look, it's this economy and refusal to explain itself that marks it out the most. Coming closest by comparison would be the lack of storytelling in Dario Argento's Suspiria and the similarly jaded vampires of Jim Jarmusch's excellent Only Lovers Left Alive. So ahead of its time, this is a film that weirdly possesses a longevity that few movies have attempted, let alone achieved. Compared to when I first saw it on Betamax, watching The Hunger now is a slightly unnerving and disconcerting experience. With the Quicksilver Peter Pan of pop no longer with us, it's odd watching David Bowie play an old man near death when compared to the output of his final album, Black Star. In the final analysis, David Bowie could have been born to play so many roles, and for many it would be the obvious The Man Who Fell to Earth by Nicholas Roeg. But for me, his role in The Hunger was a marriage made in celluloid heaven. Set inside its Helmut Newton-like interiors, Bowie's thin white duke was able to disappear within its frame without even having to brush a single hair from his eyes. So perfect was the combination. Damn, he was beautiful. As are Catherine Deneuve and Susan Sarandon, with France's Ice Queen amazingly combining both use and decay, while Sarandon turns in a palpable yet earnest-like quality, she will possibly remind you of a young Sigourney Weaver. However, caught inside the blushing eyelid of Tony Scott's camera, this terrific 2015 Blu-ray transfer grants them all eternal youth. Whereas Blade Runner's replicants were characters running out of time, here Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie have too much of it. Which is an interesting twist on the vampire story when you consider that normally, innovation isn't a vampire's movie's first consideration. Okay, so there we are. I think that about wraps it up for this episode. To recap, we reviewed Uncle Frank, Antebellum, Judy and Punch, Sputnik, and Nigerian Prince while revisiting Tony Scott's debut The Hunger on Blu-ray and hearing an excerpt from our interview with subtitler John Tilleen and also seeing what's worth streaming in our Lockdown Lowdown feature. So, if you like what you heard and you fancy having some more no-spoiler reviews delivered to your favourite listening device, then please consider subscribing. Please tell your friends, your family, and anyone else who loves movies. Please hit the bell, smash the like, or share either or both of this week's podcasts. It really does make a difference, and we do appreciate your support. That said, if there's a recent movie that you've missed or haven't heard us cover, then why not download some of our previous podcasts or drop us a line at info@nospoilerreviews.com so we can include it in the upcoming episode. Until then, please keep safe, take all reasonable precautions, and I wish you all the best for a spoiler-free time. Look forward to seeing you on December 1st. Bye.